I want to start with John chapter 1, and let me see if I can transition here. It's mostly working. John chapter 1 and verse 1, and we're familiar with these scriptures. And let me start this also. Okay. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him nothing was made that was made. We're certainly familiar with that, those passages. But how long ago was that beginning? We'll have to wait to find that out. But at some point in the distant past, these two beings, the two members of the God family that are known to us today as God the Father and Jesus Christ, must have initiated a discussion. And it was certainly an important discussion, one which in time would have very earth or universe-shaking impact, I should say, including on the very God family itself. The decision that came from that discussion meant that there would eventually be, according to their plan, additional members of that God family. What led up to that joint conversation that they must have had? What may have occurred that provided it an impetus for them to have that discussion? Again, we'll have to wait to learn. But inevitably, once the choice was made, they knew that a far-reaching plan had to be developed. Now, we don't know yet all the ramifications that may have grown out of that plan, but a few things we do know. Eventually, a physical universe was brought into existence, and it seems that a specific place, a planet we call Earth, was constructed to be the home for these additional family members. And as we know, we all live on that planet now. But even before that, a new order of beings on the spirit level was brought into existence. We know these today as angels. And part of their purpose, their original purpose, was to assist God in the development of this new family. But the plan called for an important feature to be included in these future members of the God family. They would initially be formed as physical. That means they would have a relatively short existence, and they'd be subject to an end, that is, a physical end, which we call death. And during their short existence, they would need to learn the vital principles that God lived by. Mr. Shaby spoke about that in his message. They would be given a crucial ability, a mind that could make decisions, choices about their behavior. And we call this today free moral agency. But along with that ability, God discerned that they would almost certainly, during the course of their existence, be expected to deviate from God's holy principles of life that he lives by. And this deviation from God's way of living became known as sin. And sin, unless there was a method to somehow remove it, and in fact blot it out, could result and would result in the complete removal of mankind from God's plan. So this aspect of God's plan brings us to a significant point. In order that these potential future children of God could avoid rejection as potential family members, a way had to be developed to remove the possibility of sin. So God reached the conclusion there was only one way to waive sin, to completely remove it and wipe it out, so that mankind could continue on their journey towards fulfilling the created purpose that God gave them. Their conclusion? One member of the God family would need to transition into a physical member of mankind, and having accomplished that, to voluntarily pay the spiritual penalty for sin, which is death. Now, because Jesus Christ was chosen as the Creator, the two God members agreed that he would be the one to live as a human being, as a man, and to pay this penalty. The penalty that would be required would be death. So it was decided that Jesus Christ would take the form of mankind, live as a human being, and eventually become a sacrifice for all of mankind, thus paying the cost of sin, and therefore covering the sins of all of God's potential family members. Again, when was this decision reached? Well, we're certainly not told. But from the time that mankind came into existence, God began to explain why such a sacrifice would be needed. There are many places in God's Word that point out the necessary part of God's plan. I'm just going to read from one of those. It's in Isaiah. Oh, sorry, I already have it up. Now, I'll read it in the New Living Translation, Isaiah 53, verse 5. But he, speaking, Isaiah speaking about Christ, was pierced for our rebellion, crushed for our sins. All of us, like sheep, have strayed away. We have left God's path to follow our own. Yet the Lord laid on him the sins of us all. Verse 10, but it was the Lord's good plan to crush him and cause him grief. Yet when his life is made an offering for sin, he will have many descendants. He will enjoy a long life, and the Lord's good plan will prosper in his hands. So what does all this lead up to? Well, God's plan, as we know, culminated in the events of a single day. One 24-hour period out of all eternity. We don't know when God's plan was conceived, nor when all those details were fleshed out. But we do know when the culmination of all that planning came together to become what we might call the most pivotal day of all history. So why should we consider it the pivotal day of history? Because if the events we look at today had not taken place, or if Christ had somehow failed to become the sacrifice for mankind's sin, then the success of that plan of God would simply not be possible. The planning that had taken place over perhaps eons would have ended in failure. But we know it did succeed, and that day has become the momentous day, the most momentous day of all of history. So when was this day? It was on the date of one of God's annual holy days, the Passover. And the date, as best we can determine, was the Passover that took place on April 26th of the year 31 AD. And what took place during that one most crucial day is covered in the four Gospels. So this afternoon, we're going to go through the highlights of those four Gospels to lay out that 24-hour period, which is probably the single most important recorded day in man's history, and I dare say, perhaps in God's history as well. It's a day for which God the Father and Jesus Christ had patiently waited for perhaps billions of years. It's a day that God's entire plan of salvation for man hinged upon. Christ's final Passover and the last day of his life, his final day as a human being. So let's look into this 24-hour period. Now, the Bible doesn't record that day in convenient hourly segments. In some cases, there's really no clear agreement among scholars as to when every single event might have taken place, either the start or the length. But between the four Gospels, we do have enough documentation to be specific about some of those events. And for those that we don't, we can develop an estimate. So let's start out talking briefly about the time setting of that final day of Passover in the context of a week. So I have up there a representation of part of the week, and most of us are aware of this. Again, I refer to it as 31 AD. And how was that arrived at? Well, that's the year in which most Church of God scholars have placed these events for quite a few decades. And let me read from one of our booklets of the Fundamental Beliefs. It says, there is historic and scriptural evidence that points to AD 31 as the year of Christ's crucifixion and resurrection. Among the indicators of the crucifixion year are the fulfillment of Daniel's prophecy of the coming of the Messiah and a careful consideration of three milestones, the likely birth of Jesus Christ, his age when he began his ministry, and the duration of his ministry. Now, we know that the Passover takes place every year on Nisan the 14th, and that's easily determined by going back to the account in Exodus 12, and Leviticus 23:5 says the same thing. It says in Exodus 12, "Now you shall keep it," speaking of the Passover, "until the 14th day of the same month. Then the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel shall kill it at twilight." In the year 31 AD, that Nisan 14th fell on a Wednesday. And so we're going to recognize that day as we also recognize that day that God's days all start at sunset. That's stated in Leviticus 23:32. So the Passover day would have begun on a Tuesday night that year, and we observe Passover the same way, beginning with our service starting shortly after sunset, as Mr. Graby described for tomorrow evening's Passover. And again, this year, Nisan 14th falls on a Sunday, tomorrow night, so we'll keep the Passover service tomorrow evening. Now, the book of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John each give us a rather unique description of what they observed during this Passover. And however, none of them describe all the events, and some have a very limited description of the events of that Passover. But when we put them all together, we see that there are quite a few very significant actions that took place, and people that played a part in what occurred on that date. So here are just some of the very impactful things that Jesus Christ experienced on that day. After supper, he introduced the important symbols that would thereafter be used by the New Testament church, the bread and the wine. On that evening, he spent time explaining what God was doing through the coming events that would take place that evening and the next day. And especially, he was giving encouragement to his disciples. And he also, as we know, prayed to the Father to help them as well. Later that evening, he was forcibly taken by a mob, dragged to another location. And over the next 12 to 14-hour period, from perhaps about midnight to 3 p.m. the next day, he was moved on foot between possibly 9 different locations in and around Jerusalem. And during that ordeal that he suffered, he was brutally interrogated, first before two high priests, then the gathered body of the Sanhedrin, and then he was dragged before the Roman governor twice, and also a local king. And during that entire period, he was beaten constantly, then submitted to a brutal torture, and lastly, the cruelest method of execution that was known. So even though Jerusalem is still standing today, there's a lot of places described in the Gospels which we can't be certain about their exact location. And this is a simplified layout of Jerusalem at that time. And you'll see it mentions the Passover site. That's where they took the Passover, likely down here. The Mount of Olives over here where Christ went to. The home of the high priest was likely around this location. Certainly here's the temple. Herod's palace was over here, as well as the praetorium. And Herod Antipas had a palace that is likely somewhere over there. Just to give you a little indication of what we'll be talking about here. Now here's another layout of Jerusalem. With some of those same spots described that I just talked about. And we'll talk about one more, or we'll look at one more. You'll notice that this is obviously Jerusalem today. I know we've had several members here that have been to Jerusalem. And you'll notice that it's not relatively flat as a city. And to cover any amount of ground, there would be considerable effort that would be needed. And as we'll see on that day of Passover, Christ walked to or was forcibly taken to several parts of that city, as I just described. And this ordeal or this effort would have contributed to the suffering that he endured during this ordeal. So just to give you a different perspective of how the city is laid out, here's the a rendition. I think it's actually a building that somebody has constructed as to what they believe the temple looked like. It was certainly the most prominent feature of the city. And this is what they called Herod's Temple. It was built after the Jews returned from the Babylonian captivity in the 4th century AD. But it was enhanced by Herod the Great in the years leading up to when Christ was alive. Now, this temple does not feature prominently in the Passover, except for two events that we'll talk about later. Now, the population of Jerusalem was estimated to be somewhere in the neighborhood of 80,000 inhabitants, but that number could increase dramatically during the holy days, such as the Passover. And now, with that as a background, let's go on to some of the events of that final Passover. So before the Passover began, Mark records in chapter 14, verses 12 through 16, that Christ had instructed the disciples to go to a specific person who would lead them to a room where they would gather. And they arrived and prepared it. And a group of our congregation will do likewise tomorrow when we get here early to set up for the Passover. Information that I found on the internet, it appears that sunset in Jerusalem on that year of AD 31, around April 25th, might have occurred around 7:15 p.m. It's amazing that you can go to the internet and they can instantly take you back to a time of that age and give an estimate as to what sunset was. So by 7:15, they obviously would have all gathered in this room. And we read in chapter 22, verse 14 and 15, "And he said unto them, with desire, I have desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer." So Christ, who knew the importance of that day, had been looking forward to observing it with his disciples. And John introduces his discussion about the Passover in chapter 13, verse 1. John 13, verse 1 says, "Now before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come, that he should depart from this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them unto the end." And then in verse 2, he says, "And supper being ended." So on this occasion, like all other Passovers for the Jews, there was a formal meal that they took part of. But Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians 11 that after Christ's death occurred, that dinner was no longer the focus of the Passover. So after the meal had taken place, Christ initiates something that's very important. It's likely now about 8:15 or 8 p.m., somewhere along that time. And Christ has an important lesson to give them. Mr. Shaby spoke about that a little while ago. And he gives it to us by example. It's a lesson of humility and being a servant. And only the Apostle John wrote about this event in chapter 13 of the book of John, verses 3, 4, and 5. He says, "Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, and that he had come from God and was going to God, rose from supper, laid aside his garments, took a towel, and girded himself. And after that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel with which he was girded." And certainly the baptized members tomorrow will do that. Verse 14, "And he said, if I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example that you should do as I have done to you." Again, ironic that Mr. Shaby spoke about that yesterday. Now, the three synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, cover much of the detail on the Passover meal, but John adds details that are not mentioned by the others. And to get all these events in sequence, it helps if you happen to have a book called A Harmony of the Gospel, because each Bible writer kind of had their own perspective of what they saw and they heard. Now, at the Passover, we generally only wash one another's feet over a period of a few minutes. We generally wash one person's feet. But here, this act of humility probably took quite some time as he went from one of his disciples to another, and then he very likely had a conversation with each man as he did. And we have a record of the resistance that Peter made when Christ actually got to his feet. And note that Judas, who betrayed Christ, was there at that time, and Christ actually washed his feet as well. And we know from the scriptures that shortly after that, it's recorded that Satan entered him and he left. Now, soon after this, right after the foot washing, he introduces the New Testament Passover symbols, which we observe today, unleavened bread and the wine. And it's very likely now, in the sequence of this occasion, possibly about 8:30 p.m. And shortly after the foot washing, Christ established these two symbols, the bread and the wine, representing what would soon take place, his broken body and his spilled blood. Matthew 26:26 says this, "And as they were eating, Jesus took bread, blessed it, broke it, and gave it to the disciples and said, 'Eat, this is my body.' Then he drank from the cup and gave thanks and gave it to them, saying, 'Drink from it, all of you. For this is my blood of the new covenant, which is shed for many for the remission of sins.'" So these two symbols and the actions that they represent will become, from that time forward, the central focus of the entire Passover for all the future New Testament church and eventually all mankind. So again, we can't be precise, but very likely this is taking place 8 to 8:30, somewhere around then. Now, the next event that takes place right after that, he discusses the peace that he's going to leave with them, Jesus Christ does, the offices that will be in his Father's kingdom, the Holy Spirit or the Comforter, and the bread and the wine. And all these were meant to give spiritual understanding and comfort to those who were with him. And finally, he prays to the Father for the disciples and his future church. And with that, he concludes the Passover service. And then in verse 31, he says, "Arise, let us go hence." And Matthew 26:30 says that they begin to head to the Mount of Olives. Perhaps they began their trek somewhere, possibly around 9 p.m. They would have made their way through some city streets, perhaps, but likely they might have gone outside through one of the city gates. It's not explained exactly where, into the Kidron Valley, and then toward the Mount of Olives. So let's look at a map. And again, they started somewhere around here. Let me see if it's going to do that. And from there, they're going to go this direction. We're not sure at what point they leave the city wall, but they'll head up to the Mount of Olives. So then, as I said, they walk to the Mount of Olives, specifically to the Garden of Gethsemane. And that was a well-known spot that Jesus Christ and his disciples had gone to many times before for privacy and have some quiet time. So did Christ know what he was facing over the next few hours? Well, the scriptures show that he certainly did. He says in Matthew 20, verse 18, he says, "Behold, we go up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man shall be betrayed unto the chief priests and unto the scribes, and they shall condemn him to death. And they shall deliver him to the Gentiles to mock and to scourge and to crucify him, and the third day he shall rise again." So Christ obviously knew the details of what would be taking place. And so for the next 3 hours, we read that Christ spent most of his time in prayer at that remote location, prayer to his Father, but he's with his disciples. Obviously, the awesomeness and the gravity of the coming responsibility that he'd had since, you could say, back in eternity, was weighing very heavily on him. And at one point, Christ asked the Father whether the cup that being a sacrifice, his being a sacrifice, could be accomplished in some other way. And the answer was no, and Christ accepted that. And the disciples, though, didn't fully grasp what was about to take place. And in fact, we read that they really weren't even able to stay awake. Now, the time is likely to be after midnight when he finishes the three times that he went and prayed. It says he prayed for about an hour on each occasion. So the flickering of torches in the distance probably let Jesus Christ know that the traitor Judas was on his way to that site. And with him were soldiers and guards that had been supplied by the high priest. In a weak moment, and still not understanding what is going to take place, Peter tries to take matters into his own hands by the use of a sword that he had with him. But Christ rebuked him, and the guards finally, after that episode, arrest Jesus. Now, to show you again where we are, he's been here at the Mount of Olives, and he's taken next another route, we're not sure where, probably to this location where the high priests were going to be. So from his arrest in the garden, Christ was led to the home of the previous high priest, whose name was Annas. We showed you there in that site where it's his place likely was. Again, the exact location of his home is not known, but they have a fairly good indication of where it might have been. So the time is now likely to be about 1 or 1:30 in the morning. Now, at Annas' house, the questioning begins. And during this time, Christ is mocked. He's struck by the guards. And from Annas, he's led to the current high priest, Caiaphas. And it's thought that his home was somewhere close by. So who are these two men, both high priests? So let's talk a little bit about Annas and Caiaphas. Annas had been the high priest of Israel from AD 6 to 15. He had been deprived of that office by a Roman procurator named Valerius Gratus. And at that point, it was given to Caiaphas, who was his son-in-law. But even after his removal, he kept a large measure of authority, especially in spiritual matters, while Caiaphas more or less dealt with the Romans. And he was likely, Annas was, the head of the Sanhedrin, which we'll talk about in a moment. Now, Annas may also have been the richest man in Israel because he controlled all the temple traffic, including the money changers who had been allowed to operate in the temple. And you'll remember that Christ, at some point before the Passover, entered the temple and drove out those money changers. So I'm sure that did not endear him to Annas any further. And then Joseph Caiaphas was also a high priest. He was the current high priest, and he was the son-in-law of Annas, and he served from 18 to 36 AD. Now, he lived in Jerusalem's upper city. Again, we don't know exactly where, but in a wealthy section that was inhabited by the city's most powerful people. And his home almost certainly was constructed around a large courtyard, and we find that described in the Gospels. Now, he controlled the temple treasury, and he managed the temple police, and he served as a liaison between the Roman authority and the Jewish population. Now, he saw Jesus as a threat to the existing religious order. He might have believed that if somehow Jesus wasn't restrained or even executed, that the Romans might end their relative tolerance of those Jewish institutions of which these two men had a large part. Now, historically speaking, in 36 AD, both Caiaphas and Pilate, that we'll speak about later, were dismissed from their offices by another Syrian governor whose name was Vitellus. So here's another map of what is taking place next. They have just finished in the area of being interrogated by two high priests. They're now going to be taken to the temple area, and we'll talk about that in a moment. The time is now very likely about 3 a.m. Don't know exactly again, but Christ was certainly, he'd been abused to some degree before both of those men, and now he's dragged to a meeting of the entire Sanhedrin. And this is another case where we don't know the exact location of certainty, but the normal site for meetings of this body of priests was just outside the temple in a building called the Chamber of Hewn Stone. And you see that right there. It's part of the outer walls of the temple complex. Now, this meeting would have involved priests from all over the city, and the temple would be the logical and official place to convene an important trial that they were about to convene. Now, the priests wanted a formal trial of the entire body to reach some kind of an official verdict. And it may have taken some time for all those representatives, all those priests, to be contacted and to arrive at that location. And it's possible that some, possibly somebody like Nicodemus, may have refused to take part of it. But in order to get the desired verdict, which was death, they needed some witnesses. And so they lined up certain men, but they reached a verdict based on one statement of Jesus Christ himself, that he was indeed the Son of God. And they found that blasphemous in their view and worthy of death. But there was one problem with this trial. They did not have permission to carry out capital punishments. And besides, there was concern about the people, many of whom liked what they knew of Jesus Christ. So they needed the Roman government to carry out the sentence. So let's focus a moment on the three trials that may have occurred so far. Two have taken place in front of the high priest, and now this one before the Sanhedrin. So Christ has faced three Hebrew courts in only a couple of hours, and each of these trials included a number of actions that were strictly forbidden by the Jewish law. So among these actions that were taken that were not permitted are these. No violence could be taken against an accused person. They certainly did that. A verdict could not be based on self-incrimination, which they did in Christ's case based on what he said about being the Son of Man. At least two witnesses were needed, but no two that we read in the scriptures could say the same thing. And clearly, the judges, as they start, were clearly prejudiced against Christ. Now, one reference that I looked at said that there might have been as many as 24 illegal points that could be identified in the course of these trials. But regardless of these illegal actions, immediately the Sanhedrin sent Christ bound over to the Roman governor, who was Pontius Pilate. The Jewish trials at this point were over. The next three trials take place before Roman authorities. So Christ is then dragged before the Roman governor, Pontius Pilate, in a building known as the Praetorium. So likely he was over here for the Sanhedrin. He's going to be sent back over to this area where the Praetorium and the governor's location is. And very possibly now it's 4 to 5 a.m. in the morning. They awoke Pilate to be told that the Sanhedrin was sending to him a prisoner. So let's pause for a moment to look at both Pilate and then the location. Obviously, that's not a direct picture of him. That's somebody's drawing or photograph of somebody that played him. So what do we know about Pilate? Well, he was born in Rome, and he fought in the Roman army. And afterward, he went to Rome, and he married a lady named Claudia. Now, Claudia's stepfather was a Roman high official named Tiberius. And interestingly enough, Tiberius became the emperor in 14 A.D., So when Pilate married her, he was given the governorship of Judea as a wedding gift. And he took over in 26 AD, and Judea was a sub-province at that time of the area of Syria. Now, as governor, Pilate commanded Roman military units. He authorized construction projects. He arranged for the collection of imperial taxes, very important, But even more importantly, he decided civil and criminal cases. Now, he had, prior to this, several confrontations with the Jewish population, including the perception among some of the Jews that he had brought idols into the city. Now, they weren't happy about that. He was described by the historian Josephus as being both corrupt and brutal. And he traveled on occasion to Jerusalem for some of the important Jewish festivals, obviously Passover being one. And as governor, he would have been very concerned with any unruly crowds, and especially anyone who might pose a threat to the Roman authority, which is what the high priests were accusing Christ of doing. Now, as mentioned before, he was removed from office in 36 AD by another governor. And interestingly enough, it was because he was having problems with the Jews, which obviously we'll read about here shortly. Now, let's turn our attention to the building that this is going to take place in, the Praetorium. And the Praetorium will be the location for all of Christ's interaction with Pilate. And the Praetorium is a term that's used throughout the empire to describe initially a general's tent, but it can also be an official building. And in Jerusalem, it seems that the Roman governors used a building that was previously part of Herod's fortress to serve as their praetorium, and therefore their official Roman business took place there. And from the scriptures, it seems that Pilate, when Christ was brought before him, was very uninterested in meeting the desires of the Sanhedrin, even when Christ was accused of calling himself the king. And throughout most of Pilate's questioning, we know that Christ remained silent. However, at some point, these accusers mentioned that Christ had once taught or been in the location of Galilee during his ministry. Well, Pilate heard that, and he jumped at that knowledge as an excuse to send him to another dignitary, Herod Antipas, I'm not sure how you pronounce it, the tetrarch or governor that included Galilee. So, in this map, we can see he has now been taken, or will be taken, from here a short distance over to this location where Herod Antipas will be. So when he reached Christ, finished with Pilate and was taken over to the next location, it likely was approaching 6 a.m. in the morning. Now, Herod Antipas happened to be also in Jerusalem, where he had a summer palace. So let's briefly look at who Herod Antipas was. He was the son of Herod. He was the son of Herod the Great, the one who slaughtered all the male infants we read about in the scriptures in Bethlehem in an attempt years before to kill Christ. He was appointed the Tetrarch of Galilee and Perea by the Roman Emperor Augustus Caesar. Now, a tetrarch was a title given to a ruler that had one-fourth of a kingdom. Now, sometimes he's called King Herod in the New Testament, but there was a previous King Herod before him, much more prominent. Himself, he was known as a very morally weak person. He married, as we read, Herodias, who was the ex-wife of his half-brother, whose name was Philip. And we remember him especially because he had John the Baptist beheaded. And after his supporter, the emperor Tiberius, died and was replaced by another emperor, Caligula, he eventually fell out of favor, and he was exiled in 39 AD to a remote part of the empire in Gaul. So here on the Passover, Christ is led before Herod. And apparently Herod is a very superstitious man, and he has a belief that Christ might be the reincarnation of John the Baptist. That probably worried him quite a bit. And based on that theory, he wants to see some kind of miracle from Christ when he comes before him. And instead, as he did before Pilate, Christ remained silent. Even while the Jews that were with him that had gone along to Herod's palace continued to hurl accusations. And finally, we read that Herod also finds no guilt and he chooses to return him back to Pilate. Now, again, this is getting rather circuitous, but you can see he's been taken here, and now he's taken back to the same location where Pilate is. So when Christ arrives back at the Praetorium, the hour again may be approaching 7 a.m. Again, we don't know an exact time. But back before Pilate, things start to speed up. The high priests were angrily demanding the death of Christ, and Pilate begins to have doubts about who this person before him really was. So he asks some more questions. And he's smart enough to recognize that all these accusations are purely political in nature. So he tries to come up with a solution. And one was to offer Christ to have him chastised or beaten and then released. But instead, the crowd said, no, let's release a rebel, a man named Barabbas. So when Pilate saw their angry reaction, not only from the high priest, but also from this mob that is formed, he begins to feel pressured to take some kind of action, even against his better judgment. In fact, at some point, his wife sent him a message saying, don't have anything to do with this man, because she heard in the dream that he was righteous. Now, when we looked at Pilate a few minutes ago, we saw that as governor, he would have been especially concerned about any civil problems that might take place. And what he witnessed before him with this crowd looked to him as though it could escalate into the state of a riot. And certainly that's not the kind of thing that a governor would have wanted. So with very few options, Pilate commands that Jesus Christ be sent to be scourged. So what does it mean to be scourged? Again, the mob were crying for his... Well, scourging was the worst kind of flogging that could be administered by ancient courts. It was not normally intended to be an execution, but depending upon the brutality of the ones who were administering it, it could lead to death. And the main purpose of it was to cause pain and humiliation. Now, Roman citizens were not allowed to be scourged. You might remember later in the book of Acts, they were going to scourge Paul, but when they found out he was a Roman citizen, they were not able to do that. Now, in scourging, a type of whip was used which had leather strands to which were attached either small, heavy metal balls or perhaps sharp objects like jagged metal or bone. The person was tied to a pole. They were stripped of clothing, beaten from the shoulders down to the legs. It caused horrific pain, and the person was also left in a very terrible state of weakness. Now, Pilate had made this decision to scourge Christ before he had made the final determination that he was to be crucified. But after Christ was scourged, Pilate still attempted to release him. Those are some of the soldiers, or what soldiers might have looked like who would take part in that. Finally, after the scourging was done, he was once again taken back to Pilate. And Pilate admitted to the crowd that he was not guilty of any crimes. But someone in the crowd yelled out a statement that Pilate found very upsetting. They said, he made himself the Son of God. Now let me read from John what happened next. Therefore, when Pilate heard that saying, this is John chapter 19, verse 8, when Pilate heard that saying, he was the more afraid. And he went again into the praetorium and said to Jesus, where are you from? But Jesus gave him no answer. Then Pilate said to him, are you not speaking to me? Do you not know that I have the power to crucify you and power to release you? Jesus answered, you could have no power at all against me unless it had been given to you from above. Therefore, the one who delivered me to you has the greater sin. So with that statement and the fact that in the face of death, he had made no attempt to answer, Pilate may have begun to wonder as to who exactly Christ might be. But nevertheless, in the face of all these shouts and the threats that were coming from the crowd, Pilate finally relented and he gave them what they wanted, which was to have Jesus Christ sent to be crucified. So Pilate publicly washed his hands. and believing that by doing so somehow he was now innocent of what he had decided to do. Now, the next thing that takes place is that from that location, somewhere around here, they head to an area called Golgotha, which is outside the city limits. Now, notice what Mark records specifically about this time. Mark says in Mark 15, verse 25, "And it was the third hour, and they crucified him." Now, in Jewish time reckoning, this means that the third hour past the sunrise, or very likely about 9 a.m. So Christ was now led off, and as a condition of this form of death, he was forced to carry a portion of the wooden cross. We believe the distance to the place of execution, called Golgotha, meaning the skull, was probably at least a third of a mile away, and the route would have taken him through uneven streets. So being in an already greatly weakened condition, he probably was not able to go very far before he collapsed under the weight. And we read that a passerby in the crowd was therefore chosen and compelled to carry the stake with him to Golgotha. And finally, they reached the area where there were already criminals being crucified. Again, we don't know the exact site. There are numerous ideas, some from very ancient times, but we certainly know it was beyond the city gates, and there may have been walls added and moved over the centuries, so it's hard to know where it might have been. Now, it's not pleasant to think about crucifixion and much less to discuss it, but what do we know about the practice of crucifixion? Well, crucifixion was introduced by the Persians, but the Romans seem to have learned it from the Carthaginians, one of their enemies. An upright post was usually mounted in the ground, and the person carried the cross arm to the site. And that cross arm could have weighed as much as 100 pounds. Nails were driven through the small bones of the wrists, not through the palms, and the wrists were considered part of the hand. The body was situated in such a way that the person was twisted, and many of the joints were dislocated, and as a result, breathing became very difficult. Now, after enduring almost 3 hours on the stake, Matthew tells us that darkness covered the entire land, and it lasted until the ninth hour, again, about 3 p.m. by Jewish time. For most people, they were crucified. Death came by being unable to breathe, through dehydration, or by some kind of trauma. And sometimes, like the criminals that were crucified with Christ, their legs were broken to hasten their death. But God said in the prophets that not a bone of Christ would be broken. So instead, about 3 p.m., John tells us in 1934 that one of the soldiers pierced his side with a spear. And although Christ was already at the point of complete exhaustion and most certainly nearing death, it was the spear that brought about his death. Now, God the Father did not allow this most important moment to pass quietly. Matthew records this in chapter 27, verse 50 through 54. He says, "Jesus cried out with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit. Then behold, the veil of the temple was torn in two from the top to the bottom, and the earth quaked, and the rocks were split, and the graves were opened, and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised." Verse 54, "So when the centurion and those with him who were guarding Jesus saw the earthquake and the things that had happened, they feared greatly, saying, 'Truly, this was the Son of God.'" Now, some distance away at the temple, some of the priests were about to start their daily preparation for the duties in the upcoming Holy Day. They might have been standing inside only to be astonished when the magnificent curtain that was inside the temple was torn from the top to the bottom. So at this point, Christ has fulfilled the mission for which the Father had sent him. The first step in God's plan, and indeed the entire plan of salvation, would now be able to proceed further. But the day is not over yet. There are about 3 or 4 hours remaining until sunset. So probably only the disciples and perhaps some of Christ's family and the women were still there at that crucifixion site. Probably they were all in shock and just trying to grasp what had taken place before them. But a member of the council, Joseph of Arimathea, was moved to quickly go to Pilate and ask permission to take the body down for burial. Now, Pilate was probably only glad to do it to put an end to all the dramatic events that had taken place early that morning until then. Now, the end of the Passover day, which would begin the first day of unleavened bread, would be a high holy day. So they need to make all the necessary arrangements that went with burial to put Jesus Christ's body into a tomb, and we read that Joseph's own tomb was used. But before that took place, they rolled a heavy stone in front of that tomb's entrance. So the day of Passover, 31 AD, has now ended. And probably none of them, certainly none of them, fully realized what had just taken place, although Christ had been explaining it to them over the last 3.5 years. So the most important single day in all of history has ended. And because of the events that took place in 31 AD, we, along with all mankind, would now have the opportunity for salvation. But as astounding as all these events that we reviewed have been, we find in the scriptures that God actually predicted most of them in detail. On that Passover, God ensured that mankind would have a verifiable proof that Jesus was the Messiah. As this was to be such a monumental day in history, God inspired multiple Old Testament writers to record what would take place on that day. Now, some scholars list as many as 28 specific prophecies that took place on the day of Passover. Now, I don't have time to mention all of them, but let me cover just a few. I'm going to talk about 10 of these. And certainly, these 10 prophecies should lead anyone that might have an open mind to absolutely conclude that the Bible was true and the Word of God as well. But it should also lead people to recognize that Jesus Christ was indeed the Messiah to come. So here are 10 of the prophesied events that were fulfilled on that Passover. The first one is Christ was a sacrifice for sin. The Jews believed that the Messiah they were looking for would be a victorious king who would deliver them from the hated Romans and restore the Israelite kingdom. So they overlooked the prophecies that he would be sent as a Messiah who would pay for their sins. But Isaiah 53 clearly describes what a Savior would do. Isaiah 53:5, we read this earlier, but he was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. Yet it pleased the Lord to bruise him, verse 10. He has put him to grief when you make his soul an offering for sin. So the sacrificial system that God instituted in ancient Israel was symbolic and a forerunner of Jesus' sacrifice that would pay for man's sins once and for all. The second point that was predicted was Jesus died on the very day of Passover. The lamb's blood, as we know, on the doorposts of the Israelites' homes, symbolized the shed blood of Jesus Christ who died so that we can be forgiven and saved. And the Passover lambs that were slain on the 14th of the month by the Israelites were a powerful and a poignant depiction, of the sacrifice of the Messiah in the future, though it's clear that the Israelites at that time did not understand it. The third one is he would die by crucifixion. Psalm 22:16 says, "They pierced my hands and my feet." And even more remarkable is that this statement describing a form of execution back at the time of David was not even instituted until nearly 800 years later. Mankind did not use that form of execution until the time of Christ. Number four, it says, none of his bones will be broken. David wrote in Psalm 34:20, he guards all his bones, not one of them is broken. And again in John, he records in John 19:32, that when they came to Jesus, they saw that he was already dead, so they specifically did not break his bones. But in spite of all the brutal treatment that Christ endured, God made sure that this prophecy was fulfilled. The fifth one I have is that people would cast lots for his clothing. In Psalm 22:18, David wrote, they divide my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. And again, John verified that this occurred when the Roman soldiers decided to use lots to decide who was going to receive Christ's garments. And that's in John 19, verse 23. Going on, in number six, is recorded that Christ would pray for his executioners. In Isaiah 53, again, Isaiah was inspired to say, he made intercession for the transgressors. So while on the stake, we see that Christ prayed, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they do. That's in Luke 23:34. The next one is he would be executed with criminals. In Isaiah 53:12 again, it says he was numbered with the transgressors. And Matthew tells us in 27:38 that there were two robbers crucified with him, one on the right and one on the left. In number eight, he would be forsaken by his followers. In Zechariah 13:7, it's recorded, strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered. And certainly we know that when Jesus was arrested, all of his disciples forsook him and they fled. Number nine, the price of the betrayal would be 30 pieces of silver. And those 30 pieces of silver were paid to Judas for the betrayal of Jesus. And that's understood to have been prophesied in Zechariah 11, verse 12, where he writes, so they weighed out for my wages 30 pieces of silver. And lastly, that his own people would reject him. So when offered the opportunity by Pilate to spare Christ, instead they cried out for a murderer to be freed, and they shouted for Pilate to crucify Christ instead. So again, I just read 10. Certainly there are others, but any reasonable person can see that there would be no way that Jesus Christ could control how these prophecies would be fulfilled. No one would have been able to direct his death, how he died, or how the crowds or these individuals would have acted. Yet as proof of the Messiahship, multiple prophets of God over hundreds of years wrote about this day in amazing detail. So, brethren, I hope this message today has been somewhat informative, somewhat of value. And tomorrow, the baptized members of God's church will gather together in the fellowship hall to observe this very Passover in the year 2024. And we'll be memorializing what Christ did for us and indeed for all mankind. And we'll be observing it with the symbols that Jesus Christ himself instituted on that pivotal Passover in 31 AD. So, brethren, I hope you have a very meaningful Passover and remainder of this Sabbath.